Welcome to Signs of the Times, a look at recent world events from around our kitchen table. This week on the Signs of the Time podcast, we have three guests. We have Thomas from Great Britain, Lynn from Canada, and Ryan from Australia. Thomas has fled Mexico to live in the UK, trying to get as far away from Bush as he possibly can. So we'd like to welcome the three of you here.
Thank you. We're glad to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we would like to talk with our guests a little bit about what's going on in the world, how they see this from their countries, what kinds of things are going on in their particular countries in response to the events of the world.
One of the things that I find living in Canada is that because the States is so completely intertwined with Canada, not so much culturally, but definitely economically, that we are, I find, the majority of the population quite mesmerized by what the States is doing in with respect to Canada, of which we have many, you know, yay that, you know, we're making money this way, and boo, they're using NAFTA against us that way. But it makes it very hard to step back and take stock of their behavior generally worldwide. And I think while Canada may not actively agree and go along with some of the things the States have done, they're still annoyed that we would not go into Iran with them. We're just so preoccupied with trying to hold our own that it's really difficult to start making good judgments about what else they're doing, because we just don't have the time or the attention span.
Well, one of the things the United States has been trying to do for many years in talking about globalization is setting up free trade zones with everyone. And one of the first free trade agreements, if not the first, that it concluded was with Canada, with the NAFTA agreement. Both Canada and Mexico were involved in this. What effects have you seen in Canada from this? And Tomas, what effects have you seen in Mexico?
What can I say? Mexico has been always, or at least since I remember, a country with pretty much hard contrasts between what you see with the privileged people who have money and people who do not. And it seems to me that even when the country has gained at least a small terrain in the area of democracy, for example, there are more rules now, there's somehow more transparency, not as many frauds are as they used to be. On the other hand, I get the impression that also the process of more extreme capitalism taking place is actually going stronger. It's not only have there not been any real social measures in favor of people, of common people, but things have actually gone worse. And I would pretty much attribute this to this NAFTA. It's the logic of capitalism, only a step further, I would say.
Does that concord with the experience that you've had seeing the effects of NAFTA on Canada, Lynn?
I would say in spirit, yes, they're not as obvious about it. I mean, you don't have the Maquiladoras, is that the name? The zones, the factory zones on the border?
Maquiladoras.
Thank you. We don't have anything like that. But in terms of the spirit of it, people who've stood up for the country, like Pierre Burton and others, have accused us of properly behaving like a colony, where we sell oil and raw materials to the States and import back the finished products. Although we don't, the States doesn't even have the grace to do that anymore. They send it on out to Japan or China these days. But the thing that is most irritating, especially because I live in an area that is definitely resource dependent, is the refusal to abide by agreements that they particularly enforced. And NAFTA's at the top of the list, to wit, softwood lumber. They have lost, the States has lost in the last 11 years, at last count, 22 World Trade or GATT or NAFTA judgments, and has refused to remove tariffs or abide by the rulings that they themselves brought suit for. They just lost one a month ago, and they're appealing again. The whole mad cow thing is another thing. I have neighbors who are nearly out of business, bankrupt, because as soon as we had a mad cow, chronic wasting disease, they shut the borders. The area I live in imports nearly all live cattle for processing to the states, and they're losing money. And when the government, this was the corker, when the government's provincial government stepped in to try and aid these people, these small feedlot and cow-calf operations they're called, a good many of the calves appeared to be owned by an American organization called RCAF, and aid was handed out per calf, and RCAF got about 30% of it. So the view is, from the bottom of the heap, if you will, is that all the rules are stacked in favor of the states. If for some unexplained reason things happen to go against the states in whatever arbitration procedures there are, they just simply ignore it. And on the other hand, knowing people in the states, they are completely oblivious to these situations, because I will question them and talk to them. Have you heard this? Have you heard that? And they're like, well, no, that just hasn't been in the news. So it's quite astonishing.
It seemed to me for a long time that Canada was in a certain way a laboratory, because it shares the long border with the U.S. because of the incredible dominance of the U.S. media in Canada. It's a very large percentage of Canadians are able to receive every American TV channel. And so with this great dominance, with the economic dominance, a lot of things that we see happening in other countries right now are things that have played out in the last 40 years in the relationship between the United States and Canada. You talked about the United States ignoring international agreements when the rulings come down in Canada's favor. And, of course, this brings to mind George Bush and the UN and the whole manipulations that went on in terms of preparing the ground for the invasion of Iraq. And when finally the UN wouldn't give him permission, he went and he did it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so true. And the other thing I would say is that it's been an interesting experiment for them, because they did not have to put any overt force or propaganda, because there is this shared cultural basis. Everything was done on quite a subtle level, and you really didn't even notice it happening, because we're all friends and we have the longest unprotected border and we're such good buds. But all of a sudden, little by little by little, and it's always been this way from the very start, the balance has always been tipped ever so slightly towards the states.
I just have an observation here that the fact that you have two countries, one which is really powerful and rich, like the United States, and another one which is really not, like Mexico, and you have them one next to the other, and you have a relationship of commerce and transit of people on a daily basis, has also, unfortunately, how should I call it, like a dark side effect, if you want. And I'm not talking only here about black market, but things related to crimes. And I am thinking specifically about three things. First, the illegal trade of people, actual people who want to cross the border in order to get a job in the United States. These people get really low salaries in their hometowns in Mexico. Things that are really amazing, how people could actually live out of it. So men in whole villages in the countryside would cross the border illegally into the U.S. to get a job, for example, picking tomatoes or whatever. And, of course, in the U.S. they would get paid with dollars, which would be much better for them, and money which they would use to send back home. But on the other side, since they are illegals, they would have absolutely no right. So first they have to risk their lives in order to cross the border, because they have to do so crossing the desert and dodging the border patrol and dodging the Texas ranchers, some of which are really aggressive and really do not like the idea of foreigners coming into their country. And once they are in there, they have not even the minimum rights that a regular worker would have. So this is a very problematic situation, because Mexico is dependent on this sort of black market situation. So that's one. The other one is, of course, drug dealing, which is very strong. And if you grab newspapers and read the news, you always get the point of view, well, the idea that it's Latin American drug dealers who are the criminals and who have all the fault on their side. They are the guilty ones. However, the obvious thing, but generally overlooked, is that the consumers are all over the border. And this creates problems on both sides, of course, on the side of the consumer and on the side of the producer. And the last thing that comes to my mind as a sort of case study is a horrible situation which has been taking place for several years now in Ciudad Juárez, which is a city on the border, of something which Lynn mentioned a while ago, the maquiladoras on the border, because young women go to work to these places which are pretty much exploitative. They have to work even at night shifts, and they have a minimum security, and they work in zones which are really dangerous for them, and they go out at night, and invariably every week or maybe even daily, I don't have the features with me, but they get murdered and raped. And there have been, I don't know what it might be, maybe 300 cases of women serially murdered by God knows whom. Now the police is absolutely helpless into what it can be done. They have captured some groups here and there, people who they say are really the criminals, but no matter what they do or who they get, after a while they will be more murders. So apparently it's not just one person. Now, once I heard this theory, which made really a lot of sense to me as to the reason why this is not this is a problem, a continuing problem that cannot be solved, and it is that there happens to be a U.S. military base exactly on the other side of the border, and apparently during the weekends these soldiers go out and go to Ciudad Juárez to have fun. Now, if the police happens to know that at least some of these murders are committed by these by soldiers from the U.S., of course they will be incapable of doing anything about it, because you don't want to mess with the United States, and least of all with the U.S. Army. So as you can see, it is not as simple as people are getting poorer because another are richer. It is worse than that. There are many levels to how this problematic can develop.
Well, that kind of brings up the question of talking about the U.S. Army and Mexican nationals crossing into America. I mean, there's been a lot of talk over the past couple of years about how lax the security is at the American border with Mexico, and that essentially it's just the situation is that Mexican nationals can pretty much cross freely. Okay, they have some border guards and stuff, but there's a lot of people crossing into the U.S. from Mexico freely. And one of the allegations that has been made is that this kind of attitude or open attitude to border security from the U.S. government ties in with the need for U.S. Army recruits, particularly at the minute, for the war in Iraq and elsewhere to bolster U.S. forces. Because more and more there are fewer and fewer American nationals joining up to the armed forces in the U.S. So is that something that you have been aware of in the past in the past few years that people you know or people you've heard about from Mexico that a certain percentage of them are joining up or end up in the U.S. military?
Well, this is the kind of things that you would never actually read on the newspapers. But it is also the kind of things that people are pretty much aware about, that the U.S. might allow at least some part of the immigration to take place illegally in order to then afterwards have the possibility of offering the nationality to people who may actually be willing to become soldiers and to fight for their wars. But personally, I haven't really met anyone who has come through this situation. But it is something that is talked about.
Yeah, and it's one of the things is that seems to be true anyway. Is that there are. We don't know the numbers, but there are certainly a significant percentage of non-US nationals in the US Army, and they're in Iraq at the minute. And one of the things is that they're offered US citizenship for their efforts, but only after they have, you know, done their tour of duty or completed a tour of duty in Iraq. And the benefit to the U.S. government and U.S. military from this is that obviously if Mexican or any South American people from any or men from any South American country that join up as non-U.S. citizens to the U.S. military, if they die in action in Iraq, then they don't actually have to list them as missing or killed in action because they're not U.S. nationals. So it's only when they've completed their tour that after they survived that they're then offered U.S. citizenship, you know, which is obviously, like you said before, is a real. It's just another area of the exploitation of you know, essentially, you know, poorer people. And obviously, there's reasons why anybody around the world are poorer than the average American or average European. But it really is just one more example of the many ways that these people are exploited. They're set up in a way to be exploited, you know, through economic means primarily. This is where the status and the affluent financial situation of many Americans comes from. It's essentially through this economic exploitation of other peoples around the world. And obviously then, as we've just been saying, that exploitation becomes a physical exploitation in terms of actually using the body, these bodies as foot soldiers on the ground in Iraq.
We should note that there were reports this week that the death toll of American soldiers in Iraq had topped the 1,700 mark. And, of course, anybody who's been following the news closely knows that this is an absurdly low number and that the United States, when they calculate the death toll for American soldiers in Iraq, don't count anyone that dies in a U.S. military hospital outside of Iraq. So countless numbers of soldiers that get shipped off to Germany to heal or to die aren't counted. And there was a report a few weeks ago, somebody was estimating that it's probably closer to 8,000 people, which is almost three times the number of Americans that died on September 11th.
Yeah, so speaking of exploitation, we've heard from Lynn from Canada and Tomas from Mexico. And of course, these are countries that are closer to home, so to speak. We also have Ryan from Australia with us, and as we're all no doubt aware, Australia is considered at least by the Bush administration to be an ally in the war on terror. But of course, as we've reported in the Science page, quite often the governments of the so-called allies of the United States in the war on terror don't necessarily represent the views of the average person in such countries. So one of the things that we thought we would ask Ryan is, what's the general view of the average Australian, if you will, on the whole war on terror? Of course, recently we've had stories on the Science page about the new anti-terror laws. Of course, these are quote-unquote anti-terror laws, but basically they're simply further restricting civil liberties, just as we've seen happen in the U.S., So what exactly is the general feeling about the war on terror among us, among Australians, and how do they
view
the U.S. and also the Australian government for going along with George Bush and his crazy crusade?
There seems to be a very noticeable split. Many people I talk to are very enthusiastic about what's happening, not so much in terms of the violence that's happening, but rather the economic and strategic benefit that being allied with the US brings. And there is the other side too, which is people who are very much aghast at what's happening and think that Australia is becoming far too involved with the US. And it's very difficult sometimes to tell which perhaps portion of the population is the majority view, because the media is very much completely controlled, to put it bluntly, in the same way that much of the US media is. And many important stories are just left out and or covered or spun in a particular direction. And there's also a very noticeable slant towards certain subjects which are favoured by the Bush administration and the global goals of the underlying agenda behind the war on terror. It was interesting, Lynn mentioned before about the NAFTA agreement. Australia recently signed its own free trade agreement with the United States, and it was widely viewed by a lot of the people in primary industry and production as being quite unfair to Australian producers and exporters of raw materials, notably sugar and beef. There was two very major areas that stood to benefit from the deal, and they had all sorts of caveats and prescriptions placed on them so that they were unable to gain the benefit for the deal except over sort of a large number of years before the real benefits started to trickle down, and the immediate benefits, which would no doubt cause look unfavourable from a US point of view, were neglected. And certain areas too, which the prescription benefits scheme in Australia, which keeps the price of certain medications accessible to many people. This was a very strong point of contention throughout the process of the deal being negotiated, and the US pharmaceutical companies were a screaming blue murder about their access to the Australian market being restricted by this Australian legislation. And however, it was one particular thing that was just too unfavourable from a public point of view for the government to push through, so it ended up, at least for the moment, being left in place. And the agreement is now in force, it's now law, and it seems that most people generally were unhappy about the balance of power, I suppose, how the US gained a lot out of it, yet Australia, noticeably a lot of the emerging like arts and like the Australian movie industry were completely shut down almost by the deal, because the US would have a large amount of access, which made the competitive situation just very unfavourable for the Australian industries. The legislation that you mentioned about the war on terror and civil liberties has also been a dangerous precedent, I think, is being set. They're bringing in these things, and Australia has never had a terrorist attack on its own soil. Yet, the way the Howard government is reacting, it's as if to say we could be sort of at risk any day of a terrorist attack. And with the recent Al-Qaeda, in quotation marks, threat against Melbourne, a lot of Australians were sort of particularly worried about this, of course. And it's interesting that it happened only days after Howard's proposed legislation for the new terror laws.
Isn't it funny how those kind of coincidences happen over and over and over again?
Yeah, what's really remarkable is that they don't pick up on it. You know what I mean? That but as time passes and things get more and more blatant, hopefully people will start to pick up on it. You know, but in terms of Australian terror attacks, I mean, it was interesting that the Bali bomb in 2002. Looking back on that now, it seems that in light of the Australian government's siding with the US and the war on terror, being one of the a member of the coalition of the willing in quotes again, given that a significant number of the victims were Australians, and coming just a year before or less than a year before the Iraq invasion, you could almost suggest that, or you might almost assume that that this was an event carried out, because it has been proven almost conclusively that the people who are the guys who were Al Qaeda in Indonesia, whatever, who were accused of carrying it out, were not the actual culprits. There's so many holes in that theory that it renders it completely farcical at this stage. And so we've talked before about the idea of false flag terror attacks, and it would seem like that Bali bombing was carried out by the same intelligence agencies that we talked about before as a way to shape and to mould Australian public opinion towards supporting the invasion of Iraq and supporting the Australian government's participation in the invasion of Iraq.
That's indeed the case. There was a very strong emotional current produced by the Bali bombings, which did affect a lot of other nations as well. And yet there was almost a capitalization of this event by the Australian government and the media. You correctly described it as if to say it did take place on Australian soil, because even though it didn't, it was portrayed in the media. It was Australian deaths, therefore we as a country have been wounded by these so-called terrorists. And the media side of things really pushed this emotional button home with a lot of the audience. And I've had people say to me, we should just send the army over there and wipe out the Indonesians, or we should take over Bali, or there was a case with a lady named Chappelle Corby, who was imprisoned in Bali for smuggling a large amount of marijuana. And whether or not she actually did commit the crime, there was a lot of emotional speculation around this, and many people sort of said to me, well, we should just go over and sort these guys out, send in the SAS and save this girl, because she obviously didn't do it. And the facts on the ground are very murky as to whether this did or did not occur, and yet many people are sort of jumping to this this speculation, which again has been led by the media to say, well, we should be saving this girl who's Australian.
Well, talking about the SAS, and not the Australian SAS, but the British SAS this time, there was a story this week that I'm sure, hopefully most people are aware of, where two SAS, British SAS agents were caught in flagrante, as they say, in with their pants down, whatever you want to call it, or with their Arab gear on, maybe is the best way to describe it. They were caught in Basra, in southern Iraq, dressed up as Arabs, with a car full of explosives. They were arrested by two Iraqi policemen who were doing their officially mandated job of stopping such suicide, end quote, suicide bombings from occurring. And when they were approached by these policemen, they shot two of them and tried to escape, but there was a car chase, and they were arrested and they were put in jail. And the British military then very quickly decided that this situation could not happen, that these two men could not be interrogated in any way because of what might come out, or what surely would have come out, and in fact what has come out if you're reading the Science page. So the British military broke down the prison wall and eventually found them and rescued them. But the fact is that these two guys were carrying out what we have been talking about for a long time now, and it's concrete objective evidence of the reality of false flag terror operations, where you have American or British or Israeli agents dressing up as Arab terrorists, carrying out Arab terrorist attacks, and then pinning the blame on Arabs, on whoever they choose, specifically Al-Qaeda, I suppose, these days. one of the interesting things was the spin that was put on the story afterwards, that the entire focus of the story was diverted away by the military spin machine and then subsequently picked up by the mainstream media, where they stated that the two guys had been handed over to Shia militias, so i.e. terrorists, and that this was the reason they had to be rescued, when in fact, as stated by the Iraqi interior minister, they had not been handed over to any militant or terrorist group, but that they were in the hands of the Iraqi police and the Iraqi government for the whole time. And it seems that this story was just concocted to try and, as we say, to divert away from the reality of the situation, which was that these two guys were carrying on a very long tradition at this stage of false flag terror operations. And you can really go anywhere with that. When you have that evidence that this actually occurs, then you can track it back to any other Islamic or Arab terror operation over the past 10, 15 years, 20 years. And certainly put a question mark over them if this thing happens. How many other so-called Arab terror attacks have been carried out by not Arab terrorists, but by British, Israeli, or American intelligence agents?
And in Iraq, we have the myth of al-Zarqawi, that this mythological figure who seems to be everywhere and nowhere at once, carrying out bombings and leading the bands of terrorists against the freedom loving
unhindered by his wooden leg
nor his death.
Yeah, his death, which was reported a few years back by people in Iraq, that he had been killed in an American operation.
Zombie terrorists.
Yeah, this
zombie
guy has
terrorists. There, yeah, we go.
He's got nine lives, apparently. He's,
they're not just Arab terrorists.
One thing that I wanted to kind of remark on is the approach that I've noticed being taken vis-a-vis the cultures that are closest, if you will, to American, as opposed to things that are definitely the other. So when you have cultures that have a British Anglo-Saxon antecedent, so you have Canada, you have Australia, you have Britain, then the expenditure of resources is very martial. They try to do it subtly. They do it with news. They do it with... the one thing I noticed in Canada is the particular spin that was being given a lot of emphasis was bird flu and SARS. They shut down the city of Toronto for nearly 6 months over an epidemic, very large quotes, that killed 43 people. But this was this huge epidemic, and it had all the earmarks of an experiment in social engineering. What would happen if we had some kind of epidemic? How would people react? How would we do it? But that is a lot cheaper thing to carry out than bombing and flattening an entire city. So you can almost see this psychopathic marshalling of resources where you don't need to expend a lot. You won't, because you can do it psychologically. You understand those that you are trying to manipulate, whereas the other Arab or African or South American, Latin, Hispanic, those you can just flatten because they're not really people.
So, speaking of social engineering, we have, of course, the big story of the week, which is the arrival of Hurricane Rita at the Texas, possibly Louisiana coast. And, of course, with Hurricane Katrina, we saw the alleged incompetence of the Bush administration, but that point is perhaps a bit debatable. But again, we have with Hurricane Rita, there have been stories today about they were trying to evacuate cities in Texas, and people couldn't get out, people had to stay, finish working, and they needed money to get out of the city, so they go to these places where you can cash your paycheck and get cash, and of course these places had run out of money, so you have these huge lines and people saying, well, you know, if I don't have any money, how do I get out? You know, there aren't any federally or locally provided buses to take care of everyone, so basically you have all these people who are again left behind. Basically the exact same thing is happening, the same thing that happened with Hurricane Katrina. You have a bus that blew up on the way out, and the authorities decided to block off the entire interstate which of course prevented the stream of vehicles from leaving the area.
In terms of the argument or the debate over whether it's competence or something else, perhaps priorities, it was interesting to see a quote from Castro, the Cuban president, during the week, or well, over the past couple of weeks maybe, I'm not sure exactly when, but he stated that, I mean, over this hurricane season that occurs in the Gulf, Cuba has always performed admirably in terms of protecting its citizens and evacuating people and minimizing any potential death toll, whereas, as we've seen with Katrina and probably now with Rita, the US kind of screws it up every time, and there are far more deaths and far more, much more chaos than is really needed. And Castro actually stated that the reason that this occurs in terms of Cuba's response is that all of its resources, all of the resources of the government, of the various agencies, the rescue agencies, and of the military specifically, are all focused inwards on helping and protecting the country and the people within the country, whereas in the US, for a long time, all of its resources, specifically its military resources, but obviously that takes a lot of money and a lot of people to focus on that, have all been directed outwards around the world in this kind of preemptive attacks and preemptive war. So, from my point of view anyway, I would see it as a case of priorities in the US, in that they could easily provide the necessary disaster relief and protection for the people, but they just don't care.
And the mythology of the individual is so strong that Americans believe that in a situation like this, they should take care of themselves and they shouldn't depend on anyone else. There's no idea of networking, of a community that will work together to overcome these things. All the individuals are left upon themselves and their own resources, and as we see, many Americans are living paycheck to paycheck and they don't have the resources in the bank to get up and take off.
Or actually what's worse is there was stories, many, if you can call it, heartwarming stories of groups that were in New Orleans pulling together, taking care of themselves, looking after their sick and injured and elderly, and being forced out of the situations that they had created where they were looking after themselves.
That's disgusting. That was a story about people who had got together. Maybe they were, at one point there were maybe up to 500 people, but then they were maybe they whittled down to about 100 people. And
the ones who could not leave.
Yeah, they had built shelters, and I think this was a group of tourists actually, but the idea is
they began as a group of tourists,
but
and then
they gathered local New Orleans people. But when they kind of started working together collecting food together, and they even built themselves a little makeshift toilet, etc., the military came along and just and disbanded them, ordered them to disband, and then kind of took away their food even. And this is evidence almost that it's that this idea that Henry mentioned of I suppose it ultimately comes down to the whole capitalist system, and it's bred by the capitalist system of every man for himself. So there is no idea of, as we said, of networking, of people sharing and working together and seeing themselves as a community. In fact, there is, and we noticed that during Katrina that this was a natural response by a lot of people, but that this was actively prohibited, and the U.S. government and the military fought against this, which suggests that it's just endemic, that this concept is completely endemic, that this is almost like a red rag to them, that they, when they see this kind of cooperation working together, then it's a serious problem. That's the beginning of the seed of perhaps some kind of revolution, dare we say.
Well, the term revolution, this mindset of people working together and helping each other is so commonly derided as communism or socialism or tied to these kinds of systems that really have nothing to do with people just helping each other and sharing and pooling resources and making the best of a bad situation. And yet that kind of mentality is derided as somehow being like pathetic in a way, and so many people seem to be buying into this capitalist mindset of every man for himself, the user pays, that the only efficiency can come from market law, which is patently false and indeed just causes further chaos and collapse under situations like Hurricane Katrina, when people really do need to network and in order to survive in physical terms.
You see, during the early days of the disaster in New Orleans, the reports that were coming from the Superdome were talking about roving bands of people with guns and rapes and this and this and that. And the subsequent reports that have been coming out have been saying that this is giving a very bad twist on what was really going on, that the people that had the arms were there trying to protect people and help people and going out and trying to get food for people. But once again, when people start to organize on their own, start to network on their own, this is taken and twisted.
Yeah, because it's completely anathema to the entire capitalist system. You know, you have a hierarchy, we have people at the top, and you can't have people at the bottom, which is generally the great unwashed, the masses of people all organizing themselves together, because then that creates an imbalance in their terms, in terms of the balance being seriously weighted in favor of the elite or the people at the top of the pyramid.
And the idea is to remove any other possibility. What is that? The true tyranny is the removal of all perception of other choices. So you only think that there is this one way, and that is the only way it could be. And any kind of vestiges or seeds of any other possibility have to be removed immediately.
They're un-American.
Yeah, so the thing about Hurricane Rita is that at this point in time, right now it's probably about midnight on Friday, the 23rd of September. So Hurricane Rita is kind of bearing down on the Texas coastline and should be arriving maybe in about 12 hours, 13 hours. Anyway, morning time Saturday, 24th of September. So we don't know exactly what is going to result from this, but we can't really. I don't think there has been a precedent for this where there were two serious Category 3, 4 hurricanes in such quick succession, even in the history of the U.S.
And wasn't there already a report that there was a wave, 8-meter wave?
Yeah, that the levees in New Orleans have been breached again, and that the part of the city is flooded again up to waist height. So we don't really know the effects of this, but we can assume that they're going to be fairly serious, and that they could be a precursor, or they could precipitate other events. And we had a story this week about it was a few weeks ago, about how hurricanes essentially cause earthquakes, that essentially when a major hurricane passes over land, or even over the Gulf, in the case of Hurricane Katrina, that there were these tremors, and that the earth essentially was shaking and vibrating. So the idea was that it had serious knock-on effects in terms of other potential natural catastrophes. And if you look at the fault line that runs along, this including the San Andreas Fault that runs along the west coast of the U.S. It actually runs along into and through the Gulf of pretty much where Hurricane Rita is right now. So you know, we've been kind of predicting an economic collapse in the U.S. before the end of this year, 2005, and of course the way that might happen will probably be unexpected, but certainly there exists the potential at this time, and with Rita kind of plowing through the most densely populated or oil refinery populated area of the Gulf, that this could be, whether naturally or probably artificially manufactured, this could precipitate ultimately the economic collapse that we have been predicting in the U.S.
It does provide an interesting excuse for the powers that be to, the hurricane did it.
Exactly. And but obviously such situations, you know, we don't doubt, as Roosevelt said, if anything happens in politics, it doesn't basically happen by accident. if it happens, you can bet it that it was planned that way. So time will tell, I suppose, exactly what will be the result of this current kind of chaotic state in the US, but things certainly don't look good.
We've actually already seen with the arrival of Hurricane Rita, there have been yesterday, that would be Thursday, and Friday, there were swarms of earthquakes in Los Angeles.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of is a little hint that what we're seeing, or that what has been said in this report, that certainly the effects of these hurricanes are not limited to water and wind damage, that it could precipitate some other serious cataclysms, perhaps. Who knows, a major subduction quake off the Pacific Northwest coast, with maybe, you know, who knows, a 500-foot high tsunami in Puget Sound, and, you know, Mount Rainier activating, and, you know, I mean, anything could happen here.
And we already have the volcanic activity in Oregon.
Well, that's it for this week. We'd like to thank our guests Tomas, Lynn, and Ryan for their observations, and we invite you all to listen in again next week.
And as always, if you'd like to read more about the topics we've discussed today, you can visit our Weekend Signs page, which will be found at www.signs-of-the-times.org. So, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.